I'm John Krall. Today we're going to talk about something that is as close and important as the tap in your kitchen and bathroom, the lakes in which you and your family swim, and the boat and swim and boat, and the rivers that flow through the state. We're going to talk about Indiana's water quality. We've got a great group of guests to discuss this. Bruno Piggott of the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, Kim Ferraro of the Hoosier Environmental Council, and Bob Barr, an IUPUI research scientist. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
Support for No Limits is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about Indiana's water quality. Got a great group of guests. Bruno Piggott, who is with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. Bruno, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us, and thanks for this important conversation today.
Oh, glad to do it. Kim Ferraro, who is with the Hoosier Environmental Council. Kim, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's really an honor.
It's good to have you here. And Bob Barr, who is an IUPUI research scientist, might add, not the former congressman from Georgia, right?
Please, no. Thank you for having me, John.
Certainly. It's good to have all of you here. I'd also like to thank, before we get started, Eric Bradner, who was my guest host last week, for filling in. If you want to join the conversation today, please do so by calling 1-866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org, but our email seems to be operating just a little bit slower than normal, so I would suggest that instead you reach out to us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, I want to start with kind of a basic question, and we'll dive down from there. But what defines good quality water? What are the things we look for when we're determining the quality of water? I'll start with Bruno Piggott on that one.
We look at several things. One of the things we want to make sure is that our water supports aquatic habitat, that fish can live in the water. Secondly, we look for water that we can recreate in. People love to swim and fish, and we want water that's clean that people can do those things. So there's aquatic life, there's recreational use, and there's fishing uses of our waters. And we set standards to ensure that those waters can obtain those different uses and ensure that people can swim and boat and fish.
Bob Barr, what are those standards that Bruno is referring to?
There are a number of numerical standards. There are standards for the organisms that we'd like to see in the waters. There are physical standards for the condition of the channel or the water corridor. Our waters don't exist by themselves. They're part of a greater environment. And if we truly want to understand water quality, we have to step back a little bit and look holistically at the system. What's that water flowing through? What's it interacting with?
And Kim Ferraro, I'll ask you, as the Hoosier Environmental Council representative here, I know that that you guys monitor this stuff very, very closely and are perhaps the state's premier advocates for environmental concerns. How does Indiana stack up in terms of preserving water quality?
Well, that's a really broad question. It depends on what we're looking at, right? I mean, there are industrial problems.
I'll tell you what, why don't we start with the good news here?
Okay.
Where are the places we're doing well? And then we'll go to the places where we're not doing so well.
I think probably Bruno would agree with me that we're doing fairly well with our point sources, those that actually have strict standards that govern their discharges from a pipe, those that we can measure. And we're not doing so well with our non point source discharges. Those would be the things that don't come out of a pipe that run off of
and
our
real quickly,
fields.
Can we explain what a non-point discharge is for those of us?
Right. A non-point source discharge would would be those discharges that don't come out of a pipe. So whenever we put fertilizer on our lawns and it runs off into a storm sewer ditch, that would be a non-point source discharge, at least from the point that it goes into the sewer ditch. Farm fields, manure runoff from livestock waste that's applied to ag fields, if that runs off into a waterway, that would be a non-point source discharge. There's many, many examples of that, but basically something that's not channelized. And I'm sure that Bruno can help with the more definitive regulatory definition of a point source versus non-point source, but that's essentially it.
Mm-hmm. Are there parts of the state, and I'll throw this open to anyone here, where we're doing better? You know, is this a regional, you know, are there places where we see things? Is the southern part of the state doing better than the northern part of the state, or the western part as opposed to the eastern, or whatever? Bruno Pickett, you made eye contact at the wrong moment, so
John,
I'll pick on you.
The picture is different depending on what kind of pollution you're looking at.
Okay.
I would say that one thing I want to introduce is that today we were cleaning up our offices, and I ran into this document that we found that was published in 1940. And this document said that in 1910, there were 2,100 preschool children who died in Indiana from filt-borne water-related diseases. In 1938, that number reduced to 306. Preschool children,
but still 306.
It's a large number. Today, you would be hard pressed to find people dying of these diseases related to our waters. In just 36 years ago, one of our longtime employees at the department said that he had been going throughout the state, and he could remember times walking by the White River, and it was black. It could not support fishing or aquatic use. Today, you can fish in the White River. And far downstream, as far as Spencer, you couldn't find dissolved oxygen levels that would support aquatic life. So things have changed dramatically in some senses in terms of those kind of pollutants, oxygen levels, E. coli levels, raw sludge going into our streams, yet we still face challenges. One of the big ones I think that everyone would talk about is nutrient loadings to our streams. Mm-hmm. And that's something we've
explain seen. What that is real quickly.
Well, when I talk about nutrients, I think about fertilizers, and everybody can relate to that. You can think about when you fertilize your lawn and it rains. They tell you not to fertilize your lawn the day it's going to rain. Why? Because it's going to go down your storm sewer and it's going to go directly to a river, and it's going to fertilize the plants that live in the river. And then as a result, it'll suck up all the oxygen and aquatic life won't be able to live there, and it'll release algae. Algae will grow. And this has become a very big issue in areas where we've seen the growth of algae, whether it's reservoirs or lakes or even in Lake Erie, our neighboring big Great Lake.
We are talking about Indiana's water quality here on No Limits. The best way to join the conversation is call us at 1-866-476-3881. Other good way to do it is to connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. It's interesting you mentioned Lake Erie, because I was born in Cleveland and remember being there when the river would catch on fire periodically. And I remember one of the formative memories of my really early childhood was going to a Cleveland Indians game when the stadium was right on the lake and having the wind shift and the smell just waft over it. So we've made a lot of progress in a relatively short period of time. We don't have thousands of children dying any longer from this stuff. Bob Barr, how did we do that? I mean, how did we make that progress?
The Clean Water Act in the 1970s addressed point sources from industrial dischargers and did a remarkably good job of cleaning up a variety of different industrial contaminants. It took out the bulk of those point sources, and I think the regulatory agencies, watershed groups, stakeholders have continued to monitor and look for those. They're a fairly easy target. You see the pipe, you know what's coming out. And we've been able to regulate those. As Bruno said, we have known for years that kind of looming in the background with these non-point source problems, and we're still grappling with those.
And I guess that takes us to a point now. What is the biggest threat to Indiana's water system right now? I'll throw that one back to Kim Ferraro and then let you all have a bite at it.
Okay, so I get to be...
Or a drink at it, I guess, would be a more
I get to be negative thing. Nelly. Okay. I would say the biggest threat to our waterways is the over-influence or the excess influence of very politically connected interests in our regulatory system and our legislative system.
Such as?
For example, coal companies... and regulation of coal ash. We have the highest number of coal ash ponds here in Indiana in the United States. And they have been deemed high hazard by the US EPA. We know that they are leaching horrible contaminants into waterways and devastating people's communities. We also know that...
Let's talk about that a
sure.
little bit so that we see the consequence. I mean, when we say that, What does that do? I mean, how does it affect a person living in one of those communities on a daily basis?
We need only look at Tennessee. There was a huge levee break at one of the large coal ash ponds that when it broke, the coal ash spilled into the entire community, devastating homes, evacuating or requiring evacuations from people's homes. And so that's one of the more challenging public breaks. But we also see leakage of coal ash into leaking landfills in the Pines community in northwest Indiana. They've been dealing with a leaching coal ash landfill from the NIPSCO power plant where millions of tons of coal ash have been sitting for decades, and their drinking water was decimated and ruined. And so they now, decades later, are just now getting bottled water from Michigan City. Have had to wage a huge legal fight in order to be protected. And so those are two examples.
Bruno Piggott, what do you think is the biggest threat to Indiana's water?
Well, from a regulatory perspective, the emphasis that EPA and our agency have placed on improving our waters has been reducing our nutrient loadings to waterways. And in terms of widespread issues, there are certainly issues in particular waterways that differ depending on the pollutants being discharged and their upsets, and there are treatment plants that don't work properly. Yeah. But nutrient issues exist across the state, and EPA believes across the Midwest that increases loadings of nutrients to the Mississippi River and has led to Gulf hypoxia. So one of the big challenges that we're faced on the regulatory side is putting in place standards that help push the reduction of loading of nutrients, whether it's your fertilizer on your lawn, nutrients that come into waterways from urban areas or from agricultural areas. And they've really asked states and other entities to focus on reducing nutrient loadings.
We are talking about Indiana's water quality here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. The other way to reach us, a good way to reach us, is via Twitter or Facebook at WFYI. Well, Bob Barr, I'm going to give you your bite at this apple as well. What do you think is the biggest threat to Indiana's water quality?
Well, it shouldn't surprise you given my background, but I think I would have to say it was a lack of public awareness. And I'll say was, because I think that's rapidly changing. And I think all three of us here today are involved in some way with the education of the larger population about water problems. People quite literally weren't aware of what was flowing through their neighborhood, in their backyards. And once they're aware of it, their perception changes, and it changes rapidly. The fact that I could take students as recently as 2 years ago down to the White River and tell them that we will occasionally get raw sewage in there and they'd be surprised tells you that more education is needed.
And how do we go about improving that education? I mean, what would you recommend?
I think the process of education has already been improving. I think we passed that point some years ago. I think it's now a process, if you will. It's going to take time. but more and more people understand there are problems. The Purdue Watershed Academy is continually turning out watershed leaders that go out to different areas around the state to talk to people about their watersheds. Hoosier Environmental Council has a very active outreach and education program. Indiana Department of Environmental Management has watershed coordinators around the state. Its job is simply to work with the people in that region to understand those problems. So we've made a lot of progress.
And obviously are still making progress,
yes.
It sounds like. We are talking about Indiana's water quality here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Normally you could send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, but our emails are running a little slow, so I would suggest instead that you connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Again, we are talking about Indiana's water quality. My guests are Bruno Piggott of the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, Kim Ferraro, who is with the Hoosier Environmental Council, and Bob Barr, who is an IUPUI research scientist. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about Indiana's water quality. My guests are Bruno Piggott, who is with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, Kim Ferraro, who is with the Hoosier Environmental Council, and Bob Barr, who is an IUPUI research scientist, and as I said before, not the former Georgia congressman. Well, one of the things I would think that also complicates this is it's not like, and Bob, I think you were making some reference to this early in the show, is that controlling Indiana's water is not just something that takes place exclusively within our borders. You know, for example, we share the Ohio River with several states. Mm-hmm. We get water from all sorts of places. Bruno, I guess I'm going to start with that from the regulatory perspective. What kind of authority, if not that I am accusing the good folks of Kentucky of doing this, but if they start, you know, dumping raw sewage by the tonfall into the Ohio River, what recourse do we have?
Well, there's an organization that all of the states that are along the Ohio River actually belong to that has regulatory authority, and that's it's known by shorthand as ORSANCO, but it's the Ohio River Sanitary Commission. And it's comprised of representatives from the different states and the different regulatory agencies. And that organization can help set standards and put in place requirements that all the states have to abide by. But I'd also like to say that it isn't just the across borders where the regulatory mechanisms could be improved. I think one of the issues in terms of the great challenges to our waterways is that from a regulatory perspective, there are many different regulatory agencies that are involved in some form of water regulatory activity, whether it's water volume or water quality. I can name five or six organizations: the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Health, IDEM, as well as the State Chemist's Office, as well as ORSANCO, as well as the International Joint Commission, that all have some piece of the regulatory structure, and they're not necessarily coordinated or consolidated.
Do you guys play nicely together or at times?
I think that it would be wrong to say we don't play nicely together, but what I would say is that the missions of these different organizations may be slightly different, and therefore the goals may be slightly different, and the coordination, given the fact that all of this regulatory activity takes place in different areas, may be less than ideal. So actually bringing them together and coordinating more closely would be a help in terms of making progress on all sorts of levels.
We are talking about Indiana's water quality here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you all doing? I'm an engineer up in Lebanon, Indiana, and I deal with you guys all the time, and I do find sometimes they're mutually exclusive, but I do like the fact that it's no longer dilution is the solution. we have to design what's called best management practices. And those practices are through all our stormwater, sanitary overflows, and things like that, so that we can improve the water quality. And two of the things I would like your IDEM or anyone else to talk about is just Rule 5 and Rule 6, which are both, one is a commercial, one is more of a residential. But it's a lot of what we deal with is solids and not necessarily oils or fertilizer or things, some of the things that a lot of your guests are talking about.
Okay.
So I'd like to just hear their comments on that. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much for the call, Chris. Well, Bruno Piggott, I think I'll throw that one to you. First, we probably, for those of who don't live in this world, we ought to explain what Rule 5 is and what Rule 6 is.
Well, all of these rules deal with stormwater.
Okay.
And as Kim and Bob mentioned, the past challenges were the water that came out of the pipes that went into our streams. And as we've gone along, we've improved that. But what we have still to work on is ensuring that the water that comes in contact with urban areas, with industrial sites, should, and then runs off into our waterways, should be clean as well. And both of those, quote, rules are just regulatory mechanisms that ensure that different things are done to help prevent pollutants coming in contact with rainwater. And the Rule 5 that is mentioned has to do with construction activities. For example, if a developer is building a new subdivision, there are certain requirements that the developer must do to, and people who drive their cars around new subdivisions see those orange fences around the new developments where the bulldozers are going. Those are intended to keep the soils from washing off and into our waterways. And there are a series of other Chris mentioned as best management practices, which are designed to help prevent pollutants from actually getting to the streams in the first place. And so those two efforts, as well as we have an effort that regulates communities and the activities that go on in communities to help prevent rainwater from washing pollutants into our streams, are essential efforts to really help clean up our waters more thoroughly.
Kim Ferraro, I'm going to follow up on something that Bruno was saying and pick up on your earlier point about really the coal plants and some of the effects there. Does the regulatory structure here make sense? Is there enough coordination? Should there be more? Should there be less? And, you know, what areas are we not monitoring that we should? I realize that's actually several questions is one, but I think they all are linked.
I'm glad she got that one in
there. Yeah, thanks a lot. Well, I'd like to just start out by saying a little bit of background about me. I'm also a staff attorney with the Hoosier Environmental Council, and I do represent people who are harmed by polluting activities when the regulatory system fails for whatever reason. And I'm sure Bruno and Bob would both agree that at times it does fail. It doesn't mean that Bruno's not doing a great job. He is, and so is IDEM. But because, as he pointed out, there are all of these different jurisdictional entities that play a different piece, and each of them are viewing a tunnel vision, if you will, about what their role is. Oftentimes, communities get caught in the crossfire where, for example, under Rule 5, I represented a community where a developer was building a subdivision and for 3 years inundated their property, which included wetlands and a beautiful stream, with I think it was 8,000 tons of sediment over 3 years because they were not complying with Rule 5. And what this community was trying to do to get IDEM's attention versus the county's attention, both agencies were pointing at each other. The county would say, well, that's IDEM's jurisdiction. IDEM was saying, well, that's really a county thing because this was up in Porter County. They've got an ordinance that deals with that. And meanwhile, the sediment kept flowing. So
is that a common problem where, you know, we fall... I don't want to use the term flow here, but where a problem disappears between the cracks, as it were, jurisdictional cracks.
I see it very, very often, especially with respect to the emerging problem of concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, these very large factory farms where millions of gallons of manure from thousands of animals are stored in outdoor lagoons. This can certainly have an impact on groundwater and surface waters, but it also creates a horrible odor and quality of life condition for people who live nearby. And so what often happens there is the people who are impacted will call IDEM, and they'll say, well, you know, the facility has a permit. It can do what it can do. Doesn't matter that all of this waste is, you know, that you've got pictures of waste going into waterways. Odor is really not within our jurisdiction. That's something that the county is going to deal with. And ultimately, there's really no comprehensive response, if any response, to the community's complaints.
We are talking about Indiana's water quality here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Another great way to reach us is through Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. And in fact, we've gotten a tweet from a listener who asks, what should people do to make sure our water stays clean? Is there anything we can do? I think Bob Barr, that speaks to that educational piece you were talking about earlier. So this is your chance to climb up on the...
back on the education.
You got it.
Here. Okay. I think people can do a lot. Paying attention is a big part. Looking around, looking at the streams in their area, being aware of local and state regulations, supporting them when they want to improve the regulatory process. One of the things that I think, and I'll say that I think IDEM lacks state support frequently. They try very hard to work within the regulations they have, but ultimately they have to use the regulations that they're given, and that's their tool, and they're limited by that. So that's where I'd start.
And I'm going to flip that question around. What is the most damaging thing, say, an ordinary person does on a daily basis to our water quality, something that we, you know, many of us do that we can stop relatively easily?
The most damaging thing we can do is take it for granted. Water is our most precious resource. We end up ultimately drinking it, but I can drive anywhere in this country and see waste in streams. Doesn't matter if I'm at a trout stream in Colorado, in a pristine trout stream in northern Minnesota, I can still see cans and litter and debris. And those are just the visible indicators of a lack of appreciation.
We are, yeah, Bruno Pickett.
Well, there are just a couple other things that I wouldn't challenge Bob's awareness issue.
You guys are
really
allowed
important
to disagree, though.
But it's not a disagreement as much as it is. There are literally day in, day out things people can do to help prevent stuff from getting into our water. You know, we all have household cleaners that we are done with in the containers, and we could do a better job individually of turning in unwanted household cleaners, unwanted medications. The typical response of a person who's done with their medications from a doctor's visit is, well, what do we do with it?
We flush it down
the toilet. It's the wrong answer. The right answer is go ensure you go to your collection days, and different grocery stores have collection days where you can return.
Don't medicate the fish, basically.
Don't medicate the fish. They don't do well on Prozac. That's right. In addition to that, fertilize with non-phosphorus fertilizer. So some real concrete things. The other day I was brushing my teeth and my 10-year-old son was with me, and he looked at me and he said, "Will you turn off the water, Dad? Conserve water." That's really critical. And last year, as you know, we had an incredible drought in the state. What we can do is, when we're in dry conditions, don't water your lawn as frequently. I know that everybody likes a green lawn. They bounce back amazingly well. So there's some really good things we can do to help both conserve water and avoid polluting it.
We are talking about Indiana's water quality here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a longtime fisherman, smallmouth fisherman in Indiana streams. If you haven't tried it, it's a blast. I've often wondered, and I think it's true, that prior to agriculture in Indiana, there were walleye and northern pike in Indiana streams, and that's true. Why are they absent now? Like, is it temperature? Is it lack of wood, surrounding streams? Is it agricultural chemicals?
Good question. Good question. I'll see if I can get an answer for you. Thanks very much for the call, Jeff. Bob Barr, I think I'll throw that one to you.
I'm not a fisheries biologist. I would speculate that the northern pike and the walleye are more northern species. And in our warmer water, you're going to have problems finding them here. I know they are stocked in a number of different lakes, but sorry, I can't speak much to that.
Well, and I guess I'll throw this out then to our audiences. Do we have anyone here who might have an answer to that and would know whether those species were in our waterways at one point? Does not look so. So if there is someone out there who has an answer, please do call in at 1-866-476-3881. We've gotten a tweet from Jennifer in Anniston saying, are there studies of H2O quality in city drinking water? Anderson's water leaves film in cooking, which makes me nervous. And she follows up, who should we contact if we suspect problems with our drinking water? Bruno.
Well, you can contact us at the Department of Environmental Management. Our phone number is 317-232-8670. We have a whole
Give that again in case people didn't have a pencil handy.
317-232-8670 and just ask for the drinking water branch. And if there are individual problems with individuals' wells, we can go test wells. But if there are drinking water problems with systems, we are responsible for regulating those drinking water systems. So we actually go out and monitor. We make sure that they meet their requirements. There are these things called maximum contaminant levels. That is, there can be the water has to be clean to drink and to consume. And we follow those things and ensure that the drinking water systems are in compliance with those as well. So that's part of our job. Local health departments are another good place to call.
We've also gotten a question comment from a listener named Chris through Facebook. Says, I was under the understanding that aquatics plants increase the dissolved oxygen levels through photosynthesis. How could increased fertilizer runoff decrease dissolved oxygen levels? Everybody's avoiding eye contact on that one. I'll go to Bruno Piggott.
Well, the fertilizers, I mean, up to a certain point, aquatic life is really important for the for streams. Aquatic life, the plant life as well. But at a certain point, they eat up oxygen. If there's an overgrowth of it, just as there's an overgrowth of anything, there is a reduction in oxygen levels. It's not that plant life in streams is bad. It's just an overabundance of it. It takes up the oxygen in
kills
streams.
The fish or the other,
right.
the
or
other
they
wildlife.
Leave.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
The broad term for it is eutrophication.
Yes.
And it's a problem in all the nation's waters. Over-nutrient, large nutrient level, massive algal blooms, oxygen's gone.
We've gotten another question. Says, what do water boil advisories mean, and why do communities, counties issue them? I'll throw that one, I guess, probably back to Bruno.
Well, boil water
Bruno,
advisories.
You're getting picked on here.
Well, I think it's a really good question because there are some communities in the state that have or found that they have some sort of problem in their drinking water system, and to ensure the protection of our public health, as well as to ensure the quality of our drinking water. When there's a problem with a drinking water treatment plant of a specific type, the plant is required by our agency to tell people, before you consume this water, you must boil it. And in the meantime, then what you must do is find out the source of the problem, address it, test it again, and before it's and make sure it's back to drinking water quality before you allow people just to drink it cold out of the tap. This happens occasionally with systems for a variety of reasons. But when it happens, it means that there's been some sort of issue at the drinking water facility and that they're engaged in an effort to try to get it back and it fixed and to ensure that the water we're drinking is clean and safe.
And real quickly, like Jennifer from Anderson, who sent the tweet, said that the water left a film. Is that a source, a sign of concern? What would be a sign that maybe your drinking water is not safe?
Some contaminants are not something that you're going to be able to detect by tasting. So it could be a variety of things, but it could be hard water.
We'll pick that up on the other side. We are talking about Indiana's water quality here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us 1-866-476-3881. My guests are Bruno Piggott, Kim Ferraro, and Bob Barr. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about Indiana's water quality, and my guests are Bruno Piggott, who is with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, Kim Ferraro, who is with the Hoosier Environmental Council, and Bob Barr, who is an IUPUI research scientist. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us a message via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. And we've gotten a tweet from a listener named Wendy who says, is it true that every body of water in Indiana is poisoned by mercury? Kim Ferraro, you're shaking your head.
Well, first of all, we don't know about every water in Indiana because they haven't all been assessed. But of those that have been assessed, the large majority of them are contaminated with mercury, and we know that because of levels in fish tissue. And I was going to talk about that a little bit earlier. When we look at some of the issues that impact water, they aren't necessarily coming from a pipe or off of a field. Sometimes they come from the air. And here in Indiana, 95%, I believe, of our electricity is generated from burning coal. So we get a lot of mercury in the air that comes down into our waterways through air deposition and then gets absorbed up through the fish that we eat. So yes, it is a problem. And I'm going to sort of talk out loud here and ramble a little bit, but one of the other issues that the Hoosier Environmental Council is concerned about with respect to mercury is the fact that the commissioner of the Indiana Department of Environmental Management has basically stated the state government's position, that it is not going to regulate mercury at this time, taking the position that the mercury is either from back in the day or it comes from another state and really isn't anything that we can do anything about now. And so while it's true, there's lots of mercury in our waters from past activities, and certainly there's mercury in the air coming from other outside sources, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't take steps to tackle that.
We are talking about Indiana's water quality here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Homer, welcome to the program. I understand you got an answer for us on our walleye question.
Well, I don't claim to be an expert, but I've been on small family farm for 35 years, and my grandfather was on the same spit of land before that with Coal Creek running through the area. And I'm also an avid fisherman and a biologist, so I can tell you that big part of the problem with our small streams not being able to allow walleye and northern pike, which they did at one point in time, is the fact that farmers have tiled their fields extensively so that they can get into the fields earlier. That drains all the water very quickly out of the several hundred acres surrounding these small streams and runs all the depths out of those small streams and tributaries and fills them with silt, so that there's not deep enough, fast enough moving water throughout the year to support those fish. It also prevents the percolation of water down through the water table that would allow our wells to have the kind of clean water that we would hope to have, and instead it concentrates some of the chemicals in that water table that is being applied constantly. I'd be happy to hear any comments from everyone else on the panel regarding that.
Great. Thank you very much for the call, and thank you for helping us out, Homer. I really appreciate it. Thanks much. Well, Bob Barr, you were nodding your head during that. It sounds like it makes sense. And what is it when he talked about farmers tiling their fields? What does that mean?
Particularly in the northern two-thirds of the state, most of our agricultural land had to be tiled. It's used to hold the groundwater level down
So and by tiling, what do they mean by that?
Tiles are clay tiles, okay. Originally put end to end. Now they're black plastic. It was one of the major modifications of Indiana's hydrologic system, if you will. We cut down all the trees, we drained the wetlands, and then the ground was still fairly wet across most of the state, particularly in the northern two-thirds. These tiles were literally the first enterprises in many of the counties. Tiles are made to keep the water table down, allow the farmers into their fields so that they can plant. They have been identified for years as a problem.
Michelle, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and thanks for a great show.
Certainly. Thank you very much. What's on your mind?
Well, my question is about drinking water quality. I live in Lebanon. I have the city water there, and I'm usually happy to drink out of a drinking fountain pretty much anywhere or drink water out of a tap, but a lot of people seem to think that bottled water or filtered water is much safer, and I think one of the great, you know, boons of living in a civilized society is having potable water come out of a tap. So if the panel could just address the overall kind of potability of our regular water.
Bruno Piggott, that would seem to be
a... I couldn't agree more. The bottled water that we drink is not regulated to the same degree to ensure its safeness for public consumption as the water that comes out of your tap. And the water.
Why is that?
Well, because we ensure that our drinking water systems throughout the state meet strict federal regulatory provisions, and they're required to monitor, they're required to do all of these things to ensure it's clean. And therefore, when you go out and buy your $1.50 bottle of drinking water at Kroger or Marsh or wherever it is, you're not quite as confident, or many people are wrongly confident that it's somehow better than the water you get out of your tap. But in fact, it is. There's no more surety. In fact, there's less surety that it is. And it's hundreds of times more expensive. A gallon of tap water costs maybe a tenth of a penny. A gallon of drinking water at Kroger may cost you a dollar. Evian will cost you $5. The cost difference is huge. The surety of drinking out of your tap is just—it's much safer.
How do you communicate that though to people? Because obviously they're convinced that the bottled product brings them something that they can't get. Kim and Bob, I see you both are having strong reactions here. I'll give Kim the first shot and then let Bob.
Well, there's also the issue of privatization of a public drinking water source. I mean, do we really want to have large corporations being in control of the water that we drink? Not to mention the huge amount of plastic and waste that drinking out of water bottles generates. And you know, we read, I'm sure, all the time about the big plastic collection in the Gulf of Mexico and other places in our oceans that are leading to fish kills and dead zones and everything else. So I think it's more than just being concerned about the water that we drink. Certainly we should be concerned about that. But I appreciate Bruno's comments that, first of all, we don't know that it's safer. But second of all, do we really want corporations owning it? And third of all, do we really want to be generating that much waste?
And Bob Barr, I guess I'll take it back to the marketing and educational piece. How do we convince people, though, that...
The marketing that was done to promote bottled water was significant. It'll take a while to overcome that. It was truly remarkable.
We are talking about Indiana's water quality here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Rev, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, sir.
Certainly.
Regarding the no-till movement, which is considered a progressive movement promoted by the state and the federal government, and does aid in percolation, by the way, is there not a negative side to it in that it requires excess amounts of pesticides, herbicides, insecticides, and maybe even excess fertilizing? Please comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the call, Rev. Well, I'll start with Bob Barr on that one.
The agricultural communities that we work with that practice no-till practice a series of practices collectively called by the NRCS soil health. So usually along with no-till, they promote cover crops, nutrient management, by and large, they use less nutrient than their conventional neighbors. So my experience with that has been a little different.
We have gotten a couple of questions via Twitter. A listener named Katie says, how worried should we be about chemicals like atrazine? I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Are some chemicals not tested that should be? I'll throw that one to Bruno Piggott first.
We do test for atrazine and other chemicals that do come in our waterways, especially with spring rains. And we work to ensure that our drinking water facilities can treat for them to ensure that the waters are safe. But the biggest thing is to reduce those pollutants at the source, where they're applied, to properly apply it, to use progressive agricultural practices, where it's no-till farming, so you don't have to use as much fertilizer, pesticides. And that helps reduce the runoff at the source instead of treating it at whether it's a wastewater treatment plant or a drinking water treatment plant.
And then a listener named Jeff also sent a tweet saying, how do concerns about the quality of groundwater resources in Indiana compare with surface water quality issues? Kim Ferraro.
I think I'm going to punt that one over to the scientist in the group.
Okay, Bob Barr.
In many parts of Indiana, it is one resource. When people in central Indiana use groundwater, it is frequently connected in very close communication with surface water. So we do tend to think of it as a hydrologic cycle, a water cycle. So the two share many qualities.
We are talking about Indiana's water quality here on No Limits. Emily, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I am an environmental educator. I teach summer camps and programs throughout the year to children of all ages about the environment, both local and global. And I'm wondering if there has ever been any kind of a marketing campaign. You talked about the marketing campaign for bottled water, but has there ever been anything similar to really promote responsible water consumption, using water responsibly as a resource? Has there ever been anything that has worked really well and has shown real behavior change in the people as far as their awareness and their usage?
Good question. Thank you very much for the call, Emily. Well, Kim Ferraro, I think that one is in your wheelhouse.
Well, I love the question because it is so timely with respect to a bill that we were trying to promote progressively in the state legislature this year, and that was to require education about our use of lawn fertilizers that contain phosphorus by requiring Walmart and Kmart and other stores that sell lawn fertilizers to provide that consumer education. We know that it's gone, that companies are already starting to do the right thing. Phosphorus in water creates big toxic algae blooms and contaminates drinking water. It's a horrible mess, actually. Mm-hmm. And so companies are doing the right thing, but folks still think that they need a lot of phosphorus on their lawns to make them green, and that just isn't the case. Unfortunately, and now I'll get to my point,
it's okay.
There was a lot of pushback for this seemingly benign, not very onerous law to just require some consumer education by not only the agricultural industry, but also the retail industry and others, and we're not quite sure why. And so one of the early questions that you posed to us was, what can people do mm-hmm. to help improve their water? And that is to get involved in the legislative process. We know that there are roughly 30,000 lawyers and lobbyists that represent industry in the United States. 2,000 represent or work for government agencies like EPA and IDEM, and a mere 2,000 that represent the public interest. So folks really need to be paying attention because their voices are not being heard. This was a no-brainer piece of legislation that would have gone a long way to providing some public education.
Well, and Bob Barr, I'll reshift that just a little bit and say, you know, there has been, you look at the explosion and the attention we focus on environmental issues with Earth Day every year, and all of that is some of it the very complexity of these issues, that you can't just worry about the air. You also have to worry about the water. You have to worry about the entire ecosystem, which I think was your starting point for this whole conversation.
It was. You can't separate out one aspect of the environment and say, can we have clean water in an otherwise dirty landscape? So it takes With water, we often talk about a watershed approach, mm-hmm. and we have a number of watershed groups around the state that are working very hard, and as Kim suggested, getting involved is a first step, and it's a large first step. And if we get involved with others that are like-minded, like watershed groups, our voice is multiplied. So I think that we really need to thank them for the work they do.
Bruno Payton.
Quickly for Emily, Department of Environmental Management does have educational materials for those people who are interested on water. They can call us at 317-232-8670.
Is there a URL where they could go find some of this stuff online?
We have.
or did I put you on the spot uncomfortably?
Well, I don't
here.
Have that. Yes, I do.
Okay.
Our website is www.idem.in.gov.
Okay, also, give that again, just in case.
www.idem.in.gov. And we have materials that teachers and interested people can use to educate.
Yes, Bob Barr.
No, if Bruno gets to plug IDEM, I will plug.
Go ahead, plug.
I will
go
plug
ahead,
the
plug.
Center for Earth and Environmental Science at IUPUI. We often also have a series of modules. So if you just simply Google Center for Earth and Environmental Science at IUPUI, you'll find our repository of teaching materials.
That's great.
Thank you.
Phil, welcome to the program. Phil?
Oh, hey. Great program, John.
Thank you.
As always.
Thank you. We're running close on time, so if you could ask your question, make your point in a hurry.
Okay. Anecdotally, a brewery in Evansville allegedly was dumping waste into the Ohio River and found it financially better to pay the fine than to fix the problem. What kind of safeguards do we have in place about this kind of thing?
Good question. Thanks very much, Phil. I'll throw that one to Kim Ferraro. Because that's, I suspect, one of those cracks in the system that you were talking about.
Well, I think that's right. Oftentimes we find that the penalties don't really meet the crime with respect to environmental violations, and it's really incumbent upon our state and federal agencies to take enforcement seriously. And that does seem to sway between administrations that may view environmental protectionism more vigorously than other administrations, and that is an agency discretion, so they can decide to vigorously enforce or not. Certainly there are penalties that are set by the state legislature or federal law, but adequately enforcing and providing that deterrent penalty is really key.
Bruno Pigott,
I want to describe the process a little bit. The process for someone who dumps something into a river isn't just you pay a fine. We force them to go through a process that forces them to clean up, or if they're going to want to continue to discharge to a water body, that they go through the permitting process. So the fine is always part of it, but there's another part that the caller may not know about, and that's that we put them under an order, a legally enforceable order, that requires them to take steps so this doesn't happen again, or that they're properly permitted if they're continually discharging.
I'm afraid that's going to have to be the last word for today. This has been a lively program. I'd like to apologize to any listeners we weren't able to get, and I appreciate the phone calls, and we will try to get you in the future. I'd like to thank my guest, Bruno Pigott. Bruno, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, John.
And Kim Ferraro, who is with the Hoosier Environmental Council. Kim, it was a pleasure talking with you.
Same here. Thank you, John.
And Bob Barr, the IUPUI research scientist, not the former Georgia congressman. Bob, it was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
We will be back on Thursday when we are going to be talking about autism. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producer, Jeanette Rhodes, and board engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.